At this time, I would like to introduce our moderator, Dr. Diane Nachi. Dr. Nachi is a senior research biologist with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Research and Development. She graduated from the University of Rhode Island with a B.S. in biology, an M.S. in biochemistry and biophysics, and a Ph.D. in biology. Her research with the EPA has been directed towards the development of ecological risk assessment methods to assess the toxicological and evolutionary effects of environmental stressors on wildlife and aquatic populations. Generally, this work is intended to improve understanding by risk managers and scientists of links between human activities, natural dynamics, ecological stressors, and ecosystem condition. For example, her research group has demonstrated a modeling framework to predict the risks to wildlife populations of multiple concurrent human-mediated stressors. Her current research activities have also focused on the ecological, biological, and genomic mechanisms by which estuarine biota respond to important classes of environmental pollutants. I will now turn the time over to our moderator. Go ahead, Dr. Nachi.
Thank you, Justin. Before I introduce today's webinar, I'd like to let you know about the next webinar coming up in this series. It will be on the 23rd of September from 2 to 4 p.m. and will feature EPA's Bruce Duncan and Harvard University's Jim Shine. The speakers will present new biologically based tools that can be used to assess ecological risks. I'll be reminding you about this upcoming seminar at the end of this session, too. But today, we are fortunate to have as our first speaker Dr. Mark Hahn. Mark E. Hahn is a senior scientist and holds the Walter A. and Hope Noyes Smith Chair in the Biology Department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, Woods Hole, Mass. He received a B.S. in Biological Sciences from Harper College of the State University of New York at Binghamton, and M.S. and Ph.D. degrees in environmental toxicology from the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry in Rochester, New York. Dr. Hahn's research interests include receptor-mediated mechanisms of toxicity, mechanisms of adaptation and evolved resistance to chemical exposure, and the comparative biochemistry, molecular biology, and molecular evolution of the aryl hydrocarbon receptor. Recently, he and his group have begun investigating NRF2-mediated responses to oxidative stress in the zebrafish embryo model and the role of microRNAs in developmental toxicology. Dr. Hahn serves or has served on editorial boards of several journals, including Toxicological Sciences as Associate Editor, Aquatic Toxicology as Associate Editor, Chemical-Biological Interactions, and the Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry Journal. He served as director of the pilot project program for the Woods Hole Center for Oceans and Human Health. Previously, he served as a chair of the Joint Committee on Biological Oceanography of the Woods Hole, Massachusetts Institute of Technology Joint Graduate Program in Oceanography and Oceanographic Engineering. Dr. Hahn is author or co-author of more than 100 papers in peer-reviewed journals. And with that introduction that hardly does justice to all of his accomplishments, I'd like to turn this now over to Dr. Hahn.
Thank you, Diane. Am I coming through okay?
Sound great. Go right ahead.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here sharing this time with my colleagues, Diane and Rich. And please feel free, Diane and Justin, to remind everyone of the slide number in case I forget to do that, but I will try to keep track of that. Today's presentations address some very interesting basic research questions that have implications for ecological risk assessment. The questions concern the effects of long-term multi-generational exposure to contaminants on populations of fish and how such exposure can select for individuals with tolerance or resistance to the contaminants. The research that I'll focus on has to do with the mechanisms underlying the resistance, and I consider this to be at the interface of basic and applied toxicology. At the outset, I'd like to acknowledge that a number of colleagues and collaborators have contributed to the research that I'll describe today, and they're listed on the last slide in the presentation. In addition, there are a number of other laboratories that are independently studying the same questions, including Dr. Nachi's laboratory, and I'll refer to some of that other work during my presentation. And in addition to that, there's a list of key papers on this topic on the additional resources page on the website. I'm going to slide number 4 now. The work that I'll describe today has been done as part of the Boston University Superfund Research Program. There are a number of projects in that program, but I should mention that there are 2 other projects, those led by John Stegeman and Gloria Callard, that address related questions concerning mechanisms of PCB toxicity and resistance in fish. And I'll briefly allude to some of their work, but I won't go into it in any detail. But if you're interested in more information on that, you can go to the website that's listed at the bottom of this slide, as well as the list of references on the website that I just mentioned. Slide number 5. One of the major goals of the research in my lab is to understand mechanisms of differential sensitivity to chemicals that occurs among individuals or populations or species or even among different phyla of animals. Today I'll focus on how multi-generational exposure leads to adaptive responses at the population level. And this is an example of gene-environment interactions where the genome affects the response of the animal to the environment, and the environment in turn affects the evolution of the genome, or at least of specific genes within the genome. The animal that's the focus for this research on slide 6 is Undulus heteroclitus, the Atlantic killifish. The species is widely distributed up and down the Atlantic coast in estuaries. Individuals have a limited home range, and so they tend to reflect local conditions quite well. Undulus has high standing genetic diversity, large population sizes, and a relatively short generation time, all of which provide opportunities for selection by chemicals at hazardous waste sites. In terms of its use in the laboratory, Fundulus is easily maintained and bred in the lab. It, like other small fish models, it has external development and transparent embryos and relatively short developmental time, which makes it easy to observe effects under controlled conditions. And then an important point with regard to Fundulus is that this species is particularly sensitive to, normally, to PCB and dioxin toxicity. It's among the more sensitive fish species to these chemicals. And additional information about this model can be found in the review by Burnett that's cited at the bottom of this slide. Slide 7 shows that Fundulus has a long history as a model for studying adaptation to environmental conditions. Including some of the early work of Denny Powers and others on temperature adaptations, some work in the 1970s by Burns and Stegeman describing cytochrome P450 and the responses in Fundulus. The first example of adaptation to an environmental contaminant was the work of Judy Weiss's group about 30 years ago now, where she showed that a certain population of killifish had evolved resistance to methylmercury. And then Keith Cooper's lab, shortly after that, provided data indicating that certain populations of killifish had evolved resistance to dioxins in the environment. More recently, Doug Crawford and Margie Alexiak and others have developed genomic tools for analyzing gene expression that have really helped to advance the science involving this model species. Slide 8 shows the structures of some of the chemicals that are the focus of the research we do, including the chlorinated dibenzodioxins, such as TCDD, chlorinated dibenzofurans, and the polychlorinated biphenyls, as well as the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Now, you all know that these are not new players in the environmental contamination scene, but they remain important chemicals of concern at hazardous waste sites. For example, 20% of the top 30 priority chemicals of Superfund concern are PCB mixtures. So despite many years of research and understanding of some aspects of the toxicology of these chemicals, there still are a lot of gaps in our understanding of how these compounds act, and this limits our ability to perform risk assessment. For example, as you know, each of these groups is a complex mixture, and the composition of the mixtures varies in both in space and in time. In addition, there are some dramatic species and population differences in sensitivity to these chemicals, which further complicates ecological risk assessment. Slide 9, the focus of the work today that I'll talk about is the particular Superfund site, the New Bedford Harbor Superfund site, which is in southeastern Massachusetts. From about 1940 until the mid-1970s, there were electrical manufacturing plants that used PCBs as components of transformers and capacitors and discharged some of those PCBs into the Acushnet River, which runs into New Bedford Harbor. The high concentrations of PCBs in the sediments of New Bedford Harbor led this site in 1983 to be designated the first marine Superfund site. Despite the fact that the concentrations of PCBs were really quite huge at this site, especially at the hot spot, which is shown at the upper part of this map on this slide. Despite this, there is a thriving population of killifish at this site. And these fish accumulate some fairly high concentrations of PCBs. We've measured concentrations in the hundreds of parts per million in these fish. So this suggests that these fish have found some way to survive in this, what otherwise would be quite a toxic environment. In the work I'll talk about today, we've used another site, Scorton Creek, which is shown on slide 10, as a reference site for comparing the response of the New Bedford fish. Scorton Creek is a very pristine and beautiful site with very low sediment PCB concentrations and very low PCB concentrations in the fish from that site. So moving on to slide 11, some of the goals of the research that we and others have been doing on fish from this site. First of all, to characterize the resistant phenotype of these fish, and I'll show you some examples of some of the data that help describe what the resistance is like. Second, and a very important goal, is to try to determine the mechanism underlying the resistant phenotype. And before we could actually do some of this work, we had to perform an extensive set of studies to identify and characterize the molecular components of some of the pathways that we thought might be involved. And then once we've had some of those components and tools in hand, we've been able to test some very specific hypotheses about the mechanism of resistance. And then finally, a recent goal is to investigate what might be the costs of this resistant phenotype. And I should mention that for all of this work, that these are studies in progress, and we don't yet have all the answers. But we've made some progress, and I'm happy to share it with you today. Moving on to slide 12, and starting with the characterization of the resistant phenotype, there are a number of approaches that can be used to describe this resistance. In addition to the standard toxicity tests that can be conducted, there's a lot of work that's used the expression and inducibility of cytochrome P450-1A or CYP1A, which is a well-known biomarker of exposure and effect of dioxin-like compounds. There are a number of ways that you can measure cytochrome P450 expression, including by measuring its catalytic activity. The activity that's used most often is ethoxyresorufin O-diethylase, or EROD activity. I know many of you are familiar with this. This can be measured in live embryos in a method that Dr. Nachi's group developed, as well as in cultured hepatocytes and in other material. In addition to looking at the catalytic activity, one can also look at the amount of the CYP1A protein directly, and you can do this most easily using specific antibodies that have been developed, and for example, using those antibodies in immunohistochemistry to measure the expression of the protein in tissue sections. In addition, one can measure the amount of CYP1A messenger RNA using real-time RT-PCR or other similar methods. Beyond CYP1A, there's also an interest in understanding how the expression of other genes might be altered in these resistant fish. And recent studies are showing the utility of microarrays for measuring gene expression profiles, and even more recently, deep sequencing is being used to characterize the transcriptome of these fish. the first experimental demonstration of the resistance of the New Bedford population to PCBs and related compounds was from Dr. Nachi's group, and this is shown in slide number 13. And these studies showed that the New Bedford Harbor larvae were about 80 times less sensitive to the lethal effects of PCB-126, which is the most potent dioxin-like PCB. The response of the reference site fish is shown in the left-hand panel, and the response of the New Bedford fish is shown in the right-hand panel of this figure. And in addition to resistance to toxicity, these studies also show that there was a similar degree of resistance to the induction of E-rod activity by PCB-126. So one of the take-home points from this study, in addition to demonstrating the resistance of these fish, is that E-rod activity by itself is although it's widely used as a biomarker of exposure to dioxin-like compounds, in this particular case, in the New Bedford fish, it's not a good biomarker of exposure because these fish are relatively insensitive to changes in CYP1A expression after exposure to PCB-126. Dr. Nachi's group has also investigated other sites, and an example of this is shown in slide 14. And she's shown that there's a very good correlation between the sensitivity of a population to E-rod induction by PCB-126 and the sensitivity of those fish to the toxicity, the embryo toxicity of this compound. So, for example, sites where there are fish that have a high EC50 for E-rod induction, meaning they're relatively insensitive, as in the upper right of this figure, also have a high, tend to have a high LC20, meaning they're relatively insensitive to toxicity. So although E-rod activity or expression or CYP1A expression is not a good marker of exposure in these fish, E-rod inducibility or the sensitivity of the changes in CYP1A expression turns out to be a good marker of the resistance to toxicity. Slide 15 shows an example of some data obtained with the InOvo E-rod assay. This is some work from our group, showing on the left the response of the Skorton Creek reference embryos to exposure to PCB-126, and on the right the lack of response in the New Bedford embryos exposed at the same time to the same concentration. So in addition to sort of illustrating the once again the resistance, this slide also gives you a sense of the variability that exists in the responsiveness of the reference site fish and suggests that there are individual differences, even within a reference site, in sensitivity. And it's on these differences that you might imagine natural selection could act after contaminants are introduced. Slide 16 shows that it's not just embryos that are resistant, but adults as well. And we've done some studies a number of years ago, and this is some work by Sue Bello for her PhD thesis, showing that when adult fish from New Bedford and Skorton Creek were exposed to 2378 TCDF, there was a very strong induction of CYP1A protein. This figure shows induction in the heart as measured by immunohistochemistry. The red staining indicates a very strong induction, whereas in the New Bedford Harbor fish, there is not that induction response. And this is true not only in the heart, but in all of the tissues we looked at. And these were studies that were conducted in collaboration with John Stegman's group. Now, you can also ask whether the non-responsiveness of CYP1A extends to other genes. And slide 17 shows just an example of some recent microarray data that we've obtained in collaboration with Margie Alexiak, where we exposed embryos to PCB-126 and then did gene expression profiling on a 7,000-feature killifish microarray. And if you just focus on the toward the top of this heat map, it shows that there's a set of genes, not just CYP1A, but a variety of other genes also that are highly induced in the Skorton Creek fish, as indicated by the red color on the far right, but are not induced in the New Bedford fish. So this suggests that the resistance in New Bedford fish is not simply toxicity in CYP1A, but it's a general loss of responsiveness across a number of genes that are normally responsive to these compounds. And similar results using microarray have been recently reported by Andrew Whitehead and Diane Nachi in a paper that's referenced at the bottom of this slide. So there seems to be a global downregulation of responsiveness in these New Bedford fish. Slide 18 is just a summary of the resistant phenotype. The New Bedford fish exhibit resistance to embryo larval toxicity and to CYP1A induction. The resistance to CYP1A induction is transcriptional, that is, it occurs at the level of messenger RNA, occurs in all tissues and life stages. And there is cross-resistance in general to dioxin-like compounds, but in addition, there are some differences among dioxin-like compounds in the degree of resistance. So, for example, in data that I didn't show you, the resistance to induction of CYP1A by beta-naphthalene is not nearly as great as the resistance to TCDD. There's also a genome-wide loss of responsiveness to PCB126, suggesting a global downregulation of the AH receptor signaling pathway through which dioxin-like compounds act, and we'll talk more about that shortly. And also, the resistance turns out to be heritable, so it suggests that it's a genetic change in the New Bedford population. Now, the evolution of resistance to PCBs is not unique to the New Bedford Harbor population, or even to only populations that are highly contaminated with PCBs. And slide 19 shows an example of data from a number of sites that Dr. Nachi's group has examined, where they've compared the embryo sensitivity to PCB126, which is plotted on the y-axis, to the concentrations of PCB in the sediment at that site, which is plotted on the x-axis. And the point is that fish have evolved resistance to PCBs, even at sites that have moderately contaminated by PCBs. You'll also notice from this figure that some of the sites fall off the line. For example, the Elizabeth River site up at the top has resistance that's far greater than one would predict based on the PCB concentrations at the sediment. But for that site, as you'll hear from Rich in the following presentation, we know that the primary contaminants are PAHs, which are driving the resistant phenotype. Okay, so what is the mechanism underlying this resistance? That's really what we're interested in understanding. And slide 20 shows that there are a number of approaches that can be used and are being used to investigate the mechanisms of resistance. And these are largely complementary approaches. I've mentioned comparative gene expression profiling already in the context of the characterizing the resistant phenotype, but this also provides clues to the mechanisms of resistance. Population genomics is being used as an approach. You can ask, for example, which regions of the genome might be under selection in the resistant fish. There are population genetic approaches that are being used. Dr. Nachi's group is undertaking a quantitative trait loci, or QTL, approach, and this will help identify genetic loci that are associated with heritability of the resistant phenotype. Our group at Woods Hole has undertaken a more of a candidate gene approach, and which will be the focus of the rest of the presentation. And then you'll hear from Rich in the following presentation about how experimental manipulations, either in killifish or in using zebrafish as a model for killifish, can help understanding mechanisms, things like gene knockdown experiments. Okay, slide 21. We chose the candidate gene approach in part because of theoretical considerations that suggested that the adaptation in New Bedford fish is likely to be caused by a large change in one or two genes rather than small changes in many genes. So, for example, the selection intensity in New Bedford Harbor is very strong. The magnitude of the phenotypic shift is large, as Dr. Nachi's group showed. The size of the population is large, and we think that there is substantial gene flow with susceptible populations. So all of this points to the likelihood that there is a major gene or a couple of genes that underlie the mechanism of resistance. So the most logical candidate for a resistance gene based on what we know about the mechanism of PCB toxicity is a gene called the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, or AHR, and that's shown on slide 22. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with this gene. It's it encodes a transcription factor that has high affinity binding of dioxin-like compounds, and in response to these compounds, it regulates gene expression. Cytochrome P450, which I've mentioned, and other, as well as other drug metabolizing enzymes, but also of many other genes that are not involved in biotransformation reactions. Key points about the AHR is that studies in both rodents and in fish have shown that it's absolutely required for dioxin toxicity and the toxicity of dioxin-like PCBs. And I guess a more subtle point is that there are a number of examples where differences in AHR among species or populations or strains explain differences in the sensitivity. And examples of this can be found with birds or mouse strains or rat strains. The next slide is a cartoon, a kind of a simplistic rendering of the AHR pathway. Again, I think many of you are probably familiar with this and have seen similar diagrams before. And this is a mechanism that was worked out primarily by work in rodents, laboratory rodents. AH receptor exists in the cytoplasm, and when it's bound by a ligand, it translocates to the nucleus where it interacts with a protein called ARNT, and together the AHR-ARNT dimer interacts with AHR response elements and the promoters of target genes and turns those genes on or off. So when we began this work a number of years ago now, we expected to see a similar kind of pathway in jellyfish. So we had initially quite a surprise when, in slide 24, we found not one AHR, but two AHR genes in killifish. And some basic characterization of these two AHR proteins showed that they both had high affinity binding of dioxin, they both could dimerize with ARNT and interact with AHRE sequences, and they could both activate transcription. So they're both bona fide sort of AH receptor proteins in this species. And so this shows that the AHR signaling pathway in fungalus is a bit more complicated, as shown in slide 25, a bit more complicated than it is in rodents. And so we have two AHRs instead of one to consider as possible resistance loci. And just as an aside, in slide 26, the findings in fungalus was the first case of duplicated AHRs in any species, but now we know that multiple AHRs is a general property of fishes. There are up to five AHR genes in certain species of fishes, and also multiple AHRs occur in birds as well as in other species. Slide 27 is just a list of some of the other genes associated with the AHR signaling pathway, either as targets or involving crosstalk, that have been identified and characterized in this model by not only our group, but other groups, including Gloria Callard's group, John Stegman's group, Christy Willett's group, and others. And this is just an example of how it was necessary to develop the tools first before we could actually begin to address some of these mechanistic questions. So in slide 28, as I mentioned, we've been focusing on the AHR, and one of the questions we asked is whether there might be population-specific variants of one or both AHRs that are linked to the resistant phenotype. So what we did is we sampled fish from several different sites, including the Bedford Harbor and Scoring Creek, as well as Flax Pond, which is another reference site on Long Island, as well as some sites in New Jersey and New York. And we collected the fish and isolated RNA, sequenced the full-length cDNAs for AHR1, AHR2, and AHR repressor, which is an AHR-related gene in killifish. We then compared these sequences to identify single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, and then we used that data on those SNPs to infer the haplotypes, or the combinations of SNPs, or you can think of this as alleles, at each locus. We then analyzed those data using some basic population genetic approaches, as well as performing functional characterization of the variant proteins that were expressed from these alleles. And so that's what I'd like to tell you about for the next few slides. Slide 29 gives a summary of the SNP data from these studies. And what it shows is that all three of these loci, HR1, HR2, and HR repressor, are highly polymorphic. They have a number of C-SNPs, which is simply SNPs in the coding region of the gene, dozens of SNPs for each of these. A subset of these SNPs result in an amino acid chain, and those are called non-synonymous SNPs, and those are shown in red in the table. And then the location of the non-synonymous SNPs and the amino acid changes that they encode are indicated in the upper part of the diagram underneath these diagrams of AHR protein structure. And then these non-synonymous SNPs can be arranged in various haplotypes, resulting in a number of different alleles at each locus. So this is really a fairly complicated system in terms of the numbers of alleles at each of these genes. And it complicates the population genetic analysis, but it also shows you that there is a great diversity of allelic diversity at these loci upon which selection can act at these in these populations. Slide 30 shows just a brief summary of some of the population genetic analyses that have been conducted. This is work of Adam Reitzel. And there's the sort of take-home points from this is that there's no difference in nucleotide or haplotype diversity at any of these loci, no site-specific differences. But there is population structure, which means that there are differences in the frequencies of specific haplotypes among the sites. For HR1, this population structure, these haplotype frequency differences, can be explained by the geographic distance between the sites. And so this is consistent with a model in which those differences are the result of neutral change or genetic drift related to distance. But it appears to be a different story with HR2, where the population structure is not explained by distance, suggesting that there are some non-neutral processes, such as selection, that might be occurring at the HR2 locus. And we can look at, we can ask questions about the differences between specific pairs of sites, looking at a pairwise FST test in the bottom table. FST then is a measure of genetic differentiation between these sites at this locus. And what it shows is that the New Bedford Harbor population is significantly different at the HR2 locus from the flanking reference sites at Scorton Creek and Flax Pond, while the reference sites are not significantly different from each other. So this point is illustrated graphically in the next slide, number 31, which shows the HR2 haplotype frequencies at each of these sites. And if you just focus on the top three sites, you see these pie charts that have different colored wedges, with each wedge represents a haplotype, and colors that are shared among sites represent shared haplotypes. And what you can see, if you look at the Flax Pond and Scorton Creek pie charts, is that those two sites are both dominated by the haplotypes represented by the light blue and the light pink colors. Whereas New Bedford Harbor, which is geographically intermediate between those two reference sites, is dominated by a different haplotype, the one in orange. So this suggests that that particular haplotype and perhaps others at New Bedford Harbor might be associated with resistance or might encode a resistance allele. So to test that idea, we set out to measure the function of the AHR2 variants that are encoded by these various haplotypes, the pink and the light blue and the orange. And the general approach that we use to examine the function of these variants is shown on slide 32. We clone and sequence the cDNAs for each of the variants and then subclone them into an expression vector. And with that expression vector, we can either express the proteins by in vitro transcription and translation, after which we can perform ligand binding assays to measure their ability to interact with ligands, or we can do transient transfection assays, which is a provides a measure of their ability to activate transcription, in this case, of a reporter gene. Slide 33 is an example of the method for doing the ligand binding studies. This is a method called the velocity sedimentation on sucrose gradients. It involves taking the in vitro synthesized protein and incubating them with tritium-labeled dioxin, and then applying that mixture to a sucrose gradient, which is then spun at high speed, and then the gradients are fractionated. And what you end up with is a peak of radioactivity that corresponds to specific binding of TCDD to that protein. And the next slide shows the results from, or an example of the results from when we tested those four variants, two from Skorton Creek and two from New Bedford Harbor. And the bottom line is we saw no difference in the ability of these AHR2 variants to bind to dioxin. Now, if you go back a few slides, you'll see that perhaps this is not too surprising because the SNPs that we found tend not to occur in the ligand binding domain of these proteins, but they occur more toward the C-terminal end of the protein, which is functionally involved in transcriptional activation. So the second assay we did then was to measure the ability to activate transcription using a transient transfection assay, which is shown in slide 35. And the procedure, briefly, is to take these plasmids encoding HR2 and ARNT2 and a reporter gene plasmid consisting of a luciferase reporter gene regulated by an AH receptor response element, and transfect those all into a cell line, expose the cells to an inducer, and then measure the expression of the reporter gene through a luciferase assay. And slide 36 shows an example of the results we've obtained so far with this approach. And again, the bottom line is that we see no difference in the ability of the HR2 variants to activate transcription in response to TCDD. And we've also done this with using PCB126 as the inducer in similar results, no difference that we can see between these variant AHR2s. So, slide 37, you might ask whether these methods are sensitive enough to detect biologically relevant differences in the function of these AHR2 variants. It's a really good question, and I have a partial answer for it, and that is that we've used the same methods in other studies, as shown in slide 38, to look at bird species differences in sensitivity and the role of AHRs in the mechanism of those differences. And what we find is that, for example, when we look at chickens and terns, which differ quite dramatically in their sensitivity to dioxin, we see that their AH receptors show a corresponding difference in the ability to bind TCDD. The tern AHRs have a much lower binding affinity for TCDD, and this is reflected also in the inability to activate transcription using the tern AHR. And we've managed to trace these differences between the chicken and tern AHR to two amino acids in the middle of the ligand binding domain. There have been a number of follow-up studies by Sean Kennedy's group at Environment Canada, and an example of these is shown in slide 39. And they've now looked at about 75 species of birds where they sequenced the ligand binding domain. And they find that, in general, these two amino acids that we identified from the chicken and tern studies are able to predict the sensitivity of these other species to dioxin-like compounds. And in these studies, again, the differences in AH receptor function can be easily measured by ligand binding assay and transient transfection assay. So the methods we're using are certainly sensitive in that case for measuring differences in AHR function. And it suggests to us that the killifish AHRs differ in perhaps in other functional characteristics that are not as easily measured in these cell culture systems that we're using. So we're continuing to explore the function of these AHR2 variants to see if we can identify any differences. And then in the last few slides, I'd just like to mention briefly the issue of costs of chemical resistance. And I know that Rich is going to talk about this in a little bit more detail in the following talk. But one can certainly ask whether this resistance to PCBs, which is beneficial for the fish at the site, carries with it some costs in terms of altered sensitivity to other effects. And certainly one cost is an ecological cost, which is that there is an enhanced accumulation of PCBs in these resistant fish, which can then be passed on to predators. In addition, you might imagine that the PCB-resistant fish, which are also resistant to CYP1A induction, might exhibit increased sensitivity to certain compounds that require CYP1A for detoxification. In addition, there is potential for altered sensitivity to other kinds of stressors, such as xenoestrogens or oxidative stress or environmental stressors like hypoxia. And just one example of this from some preliminary studies done by Matt Jenny in my group, slide 41, shows that New Bedford Harbor larvae appear to be somewhat more sensitive to hypoxia. And we also have some recent data from Alicia Timilarigi showing that they appear to be more sensitive to oxidative stress as well. And then slide 42 shows some results from Gloria Keller's lab on these New Bedford fish, showing that they have altered expression of estrogen receptor alpha and other estrogen-regulated genes, as well as altered responsiveness to estrogens. So again, another example of what might be considered a cost of the dioxin resistance, although in this case, whether it's related to the dioxin resistance or it's an independently evolved change in estrogen signaling is not clear. So, slide 43, so these and other studies suggest that the PCB-resistant fish may have altered response to other stressors, perhaps occurring through altered crosstalk between AHR signaling and other pathways. There are a number of studies now showing that AHR exhibits crosstalk with estrogen signaling and with hypoxia signaling and a number of other pathways. So you might imagine that downregulated AHR signaling could affect the response of these other pathways as well. Slide 44 is a list of the take-home points from this presentation. Rather than reading through these, in the interest of time, since I've gone over a bit, I'll just let you read those on your own, and I'll move on to slide 45 to acknowledge a large number of people who have been involved in this research over the years, colleagues at Woods Hole as well as collaborators elsewhere, and it's been really a lot of fun and quite satisfying to work with all these people. And I'd like to especially point out to Bill Karchner and Diana Franks, who have been with me since the beginning of this project and have really contributed quite a lot to it, and also members of John Stegeman's group, who we've collaborated with for many years, Diane Nachi's group, Rich DiGiulio's group at Duke, Gloria Callard's group, and Margie Alexiak at the University of Miami, and then Sean Kennedy and his lab, who we've collaborated with on the bird AHR studies. So thank you very much, and I guess there's some time for some questions.
Yes, thanks, Mark, for a great presentation. We do have time for some questions, and we can first go to the phone lines. If you'd like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute, pressing star 6, and state your name and organization, then go on ahead and ask your question. I don't know if we have any questions on the line, but we do have some questions from our internet participants. And we have time for about one question. And the question that came through from Narragansett, Rhode Island, one of my colleagues, is a question about whether you can speculate, based on your expertise in evolutionary biology, about whether you think there are other species, especially other fish species, that might demonstrate these sort of adaptive responses.
Oh, that's a good question. Among fish species, there is quite a range of sensitivity to dioxin-like compounds. For example, zebrafish are sort of at the lower end of sensitivity, whereas some of the salmonids, like rainbow trout, are extremely sensitive. And we've always sort of wondered why there are these dramatic differences among species. And there has been some speculation about whether the number of AH receptors that a particular species has might have any relationship to sensitivity. And the salmonids in particular, because of a somewhat recent genome duplication in that lineage, tends to have more AH receptor genes than other species. But why, you know, why they would have evolved, why a certain species would have evolved greater sensitivity or in contrast greater resistance to, you know, compounds that have only been around in appreciable amounts for the last 60 years. I think that's a real mystery.
Thanks, Mark. We have time for one other question. We have a question from an internet participant, Mary Walker, the University of New Mexico. And she asks, have any epigenetic mechanisms, such as changes in methylation, been investigated?
The answer is yes. There have been some investigations of methylation on the CYP1A promoter, some work carried out by Alicia Timularegui and Rich DiGiulio's lab on the Elizabeth River population, and Rich can talk more about that. There's also some work that was done by Xavier Azuaga and Audrey Elskis' lab, I think on the Newark population, again looking at CYP1A promoter. And we've done a little bit of work in New Bedford. Neil Aluru has looked at methylation patterns in the AHR genes from New Bedford, New Bedford Harbor and the reference site. And in all of these studies, there's no evidence that I can see of methylation differences in the resistant versus the sensitive fish.
Thanks. One more quick question from an internet participant, and that is from Joe Rieger of the Elizabeth River Project in Portsmouth, Virginia. And he asks, have you looked at other trade-offs which these fish might have outside of hypoxia?
Well, outside of hypoxia, we've looked at oxidative stress, resistance to oxidative stress, and as I mentioned there, the New Bedford fish do appear to be more sensitive to oxidative stress, but we haven't gone beyond that yet. We haven't looked at any other stressors. But if there are some good candidates, I'd be happy to hear about them.
All right. Thank you very much, Mark. In the interest of time, I think we should move on to Dr. DiGiulio. If there are other questions for Dr. Hahn, we can entertain those after Dr. DiGiulio speaks. Today, I would also like to introduce to you Richard DiGiulio, a professor of environmental toxicology in the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. At Duke, Rich serves as director of the Integrated Toxicology and Environmental Health Program, is director of the Superfund Basic Research Center, director of the Center on Environmental Health, Policy, and Disease Vulnerability, and co-principal investigator for the Center for the Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology. He received a BA in comparative literature from the University of Texas at Austin, then took a turn for his master's degree in wildlife biology from Louisiana State University and his PhD in environmental toxicology from Virginia Polytech Institute and State University. Dr. DiGiulio has published extensively on subjects including biochemical and molecular mechanisms of adaptation and toxicity, biomarkers for chemical exposure and toxicity, effects of chemical mixtures, and chemical contamination of sediments. His current work focuses on mechanisms by which polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, and nanomaterials perturb embryonic development in fish models, including zebrafish and killifish. His work also includes a focus on the evolutionary consequences of hydrocarbon pollution on fish populations, and the ecological and health impacts of mountaintop coal mining. Additionally, he has organized symposia and workshops and written on the broader subject of interconnections between human health and ecological integrity. Dr. DiGiulio serves as an advisor for the Science Advisory Board of the U.S. EPA. He's a member of the Computational Toxicology Committee for the Board of Science Counselors, also for the U.S. EPA, and a member of the National Academy of Science Committee on Exposure Assessment in the 21st century. He is also an associate editor for Environmental Health Perspectives. And with that, I would like to ask Dr. DiGiulio to please give us his presentation.
Thank you, Diane. Thanks for that wonderful introduction, and thanks to all of you for listening today. And as usual, Mark is a hard act to follow. Really gave a great talk and really helped a lot to explain some of the biology better than I can. That is also highly related to my subject, which is a similar story, but with some interesting differences in a PAH impacted system in Southeast Virginia, the Elizabeth River. So I'm here on slide 46, and as with Mark, this research largely emanates from our Superfund Center here at Duke, which the focus is on developmental effects and later life consequences of Superfund chemicals, particularly organophosphates, PAHs, PBDs, and nanomaterials. And my project is affectionately referred to as Project Number 4, which is one of the two non-biomedical projects. Now I'm on slide 48, and really don't need to repeat this. Mark showed pretty much the same information. I would like to emphasize again, though, as Mark did, that it's sort of interesting that, you know, fungalists are considered a very tough organism, and they are. I mean, they're we would say they're stress adapted in terms of being able to withstand variances of salinity, temperature, oxygen, and so forth. However, it is interesting that they are not particularly resistant or to chemicals. In other words, as Mark mentioned, they're very sensitive to the oxygen-like compounds, and with the number of chemicals we've looked at, they are typically at least moderate, so they're not so tough in regard to chemical exposures. So moving on to slide 49 to sort of orient you. Down at the bottom, you see the Elizabeth River. The Elizabeth River has three subsystems, the southern branch, eastern branch, and the western branch. And the work I'll be talking about is largely done on the southern branch. And then we use the Kings Creek, which is up near the mouth of the York River, adjacent to Mojave Bay, as our reference site. And this site has been used extensively by us and other researchers, such particularly those at Virginia Marine Science that I'll mention. A particular interest, the one that's probably caught the most attention, is a population inhabiting adjacent to a former creosote plant called Atlantic Wood Industries. And this is now an active Superfund site slated for cleanup, but it hasn't been yet so far. And the main culprit at this site is creosote, and creosote is largely composed of hydrocarbons and mainly PAHs. This site operated from the 20s to the early 90s, and researchers at Venn's originally reported that the sediment extracts were highly toxic to fungalists from clean sites. And so slide 51 just shows some representative PAHs, those in red being class B2 carcinogens, and certainly this is the toxicity that's most associated with PAHs. And I think it's really only relatively recent years that their potential potency as developmental toxicants has come to light. You'll see really very little of this in the literature, or say the textbooks at least, on PAHs. Now on slide 52, probably many of you are aware, PAHs are simply the product generally of low temperature burning, so the sources are ubiquitous. One thing I'd like to point out is that they are a class of chemicals that's slowly increasing in the environment, generally associated with increasing populations, increasing urbanization, including coastal zones, and the continued use of fossil fuels. And then the lower right shows the use as wood treatment as creosote. And, of course, oil spills has so dramatically exemplified by the Deep Horizon explosion and spill is another important source of PAHs. So the Elizabeth River fungus population was really first got attention in the early 90s when a group of investigators, particularly Wolfgang Vogelbein and Peter Van Veld, first noticed that there were high rates of liver cancer in this Atlantic Wood site population, which wasn't really surprising considering the very high levels of PAHs at this site. But interestingly, from an ecological perspective, they were thriving. We continue to have, throughout the years, have absolutely no problem catching many, many fungalists to bring back to the lab and so forth. And also, it was originally reported by Peter Van Veld that at a presentation at CTAC that the larvae of adults captured in the field were resistant relative to Kings Creek fish to sediment exposure, sediments being from that polluted Elizabeth River site. So slide 55 has the questions we've been looking at. Some of those you'll see are similar to what Mark's addressed. We want to know, are these adaptations genetically based? What biological effect was driving the adaptation? Are there evolutionary consequences? What mechanisms underlie both the toxicities and adaptations? And how might these ramify environmental management and policy? So this slide 56 is showing an early experiment looking first at this issue of genetics and inheritance. And this is Joel Meyer, was my first PhD student involved in this project, who's now an assistant professor here in the Nicholas School. And so if you look at this, you'll see the K and E stands for Kings Creek and Elizabeth River. And so we have in red our offspring of Kings Creek male and female, in the green Elizabeth River male and female, and then the white and orange are the crosses from the two different sexes. And so this shows, certainly indicating that, yes, the offspring from the Elizabeth River pure lines are much more resistant to this Elizabeth River sediment pore water than the Kings Creek fish. And it's also interesting that the two crosses show pretty much an exact intermediate resistance, which is, I would say, some evidence of a genetic effect, although we're still only looking at F1, so it's not as clear. But also that there's no so-called maternal effect, that regardless of the of which parent came from Elizabeth River, that midterm resistance is the same. In moving now to slide 57, when we first started this work, we really, we were just going with the fact that we were told that they were resistant. The Elizabeth River fish were resistant to the acute, i.e., lethal effects of these sediment extracts, and we really wasn't sure, well, what really is killing them. And as just in the course of doing this work, we came to realize that really it was cardiovascular development that was the key endpoint, that it was likely to be the key toxicity in clean site fish, and also probably the toxicity that was driving evolution. In other words, the drive was to protect from these effects on cardiovascular development. And what you're seeing here, that you'll see the slide, these pictures a lot, from 0, 1, and 2 sort of semi-quantitative deformity score we've developed. On the left, you see the nice two-chambered fungulous heart. The 1 is sort of an intermediate teratogenesis. You're starting to get this stretchy heart. And then in slide 2, you have what's very, what we call tube heart. And at least from a gross perspective, this effect is quite reminiscent of the same sorts of effects we'd see in embryos exposed to the dioxin-like compounds that Mark described. Also, I'll say that you can get this with some individual pHs, but mixtures, and it'll be an important part of my talk, are far more potent than any individual pH that we've examined. So this is now jumping right pretty much to the present. This is some data generated by Brian Clark, who just received his PhD here in my lab just last month. And so he wanted to push this further and go back and look down to the F2 generation to get a better handle on it, the likelihood that this resistance is genetic. And basically, in a nutshell, this data is saying, yes, it very likely is. So we have the left bar is Kings Creek, the middle bar is F1s, and the right bar is F2s. And you'll see there is no bar ever for F1s. That's because they're showing complete resistance. Then you see that BKF is one of the more potent, well, it's the most potent pH that we've looked at. Does, at the relatively high concentration, 300 parts per billion, is showing deformities in the Kings Creek, no significant deformities in either generation of Elizabeth River. Similar response with PCBs, and so this is basically confirming or showing again what Mark already showed you, that the Elizabeth River fish do show this very strong cross resistance to PCB, and this actually is PCB-126. And in the third slide, this will be expanded on a lot later, showing this synergistic activity between us. Here you see a much lower concentration of BKF with fluoranthine, which by itself is not cardiotoxic or embryotoxic. So this data basically saying, yes, this does really appear to be
a genetic resistance. The first report of a biochemical alteration with this, associated with the resistance was provided by Peter Van Vell's group in this 1995 article shown here, where he showed this lack of induction in wild-caught Elizabeth River males. And so basically what he's doing, in other words, he was catching wild fish, bringing into the lab, letting them decorate for a while, then exposing them to either 3-methylcalanthrene, a potent inducer, pH-type inducer, and Elizabeth River extract, and showing essentially no induction in the Elizabeth River fish. And, you know, I'd like to credit Pete, who has been a great colleague and is really responsible for my first getting interested in this Elizabeth River story. So, as we got interested in this embryo effects, we were really pleased to be able to take advantage of this excellent technique that Diane developed in her lab at Narragansett, being able to actually measure CYP1A activity non-destructively in a living embryo. It's a pretty amazing assay. So you can do things like look at, well, what happens if we induce early in life, and then what happens to that fish later in life, and various neat things you can do with this assay. We use it extensively. And so this is showing how that assay works, where you just put in the little bottom, there is the embryo, you put your whatever agonist or chemical you're interested in, the substrate for P450 converts that to this fluorescent product, resorufin, and in slide 61, they're just sort of seeing various images showing collection of that fluorescent product in the urinary bladder of the jellyfish embryo. So similarly then, Brian, along with that, the research I just showed you, wanted to look at this heritability of that lack of inducibility, and we see, again, very much the same sort of thing. With both BKF and PCB, we're seeing, you know, you're seeing some slight increase, but not significant. In other words, there's still, there is a bit of an increase in the F2s, but it's still way below the parental generation, suggesting that at least to some extent, this resistance to induction is also heritable. And again, this is all quite consistent with the PCB story that Mark has described. So we then wanted to get further into some of the mechanisms of pH toxicity and adaptation. I'm on slide 63, now in slide 64. And this next few slides are some of my favorites, actually, showing how stupid I am. But this slide this data was generated from Dina Wassenberg, was sort of the PhD student who followed on Joel Meyer in this line. And back then, we were highly focused on P450 and weren't thinking as much as we probably should have been about the aryl hydrocarbon receptor. So we had this idea that, well, if we take naive fish, this experiment is all fish done, all Kings Creek-based fish. If we take them and chemically inhibit their P450, will we be able to turn them in to resistant Elizabeth River type of fish? So this first slide here, slide 64, is showing this sort of serial dilution to the Elizabeth River sediment extract. The bar is showing this aryl activity, showing, you know, this nice dose response kind of leveling off at around the 1 to 100 dilutions. And then the line is showing the deformity index, showing that, yeah, it starts to get toxic at the 1 to 10, and then by the 1 to 4 dilution, highly toxic. Then moving to slide 65, is now we've added alpha naphthalene, a potent P450 inhibitor, and this is basically showing that, yes, we are, as we hoped we would, getting this inhibition of aryl activity. So at this point, we were thinking, well, okay, we've knocked down their P450, so we're going to make them like more like Elizabeth River fish, in that that toxicity shown at the 1 to 4 dilution will go down. The next slide, 66, shows the exact opposite happened. In other words, we get, and this was, when I first saw this data, I was really taken aback. So here we see evidence for a really remarkable synergy between this extract in this case and ANF. And this extract we know has a lot of AHR type agonist of the pH type. So here's another picture of some Elizabeth River hydrocarbons, and this time we're showing you how some of these are known AHR agonists in blue. Don't have benzo K for anything, but it should definitely be here. It's actually more potent than any of those shown. And then, however, some others, such as fluoranthine, are potent P450 inhibitors. And I'll note that in the years we've been studying Elizabeth River, fluoranthine is the most abundant PAH at around 25%, and benzoylpyrimine is about the second most plentiful pH there at around 10 to 12%. So there's tons of data I can show on this, but I don't want to belabor it, but we didn't want to keep working with this mud, and we've shown in numerous times, just like Mark, all these papers are in that supplement, that link you have at the end of the talk. But we've shown this pretty incredible synergy between PAHs that act as AHR agonists and those that act as P450 inhibitors. We started a lot of this work with sort of the models, beta-naphthalene and alpha-naphthalene, in part because beta-naphthalene is well characterized and an inducer, and it's rather safe to work with. It's not a carcinogen. But more recently, we've been working mostly with benzoylpyrimine and BKF, which are both good inducers and carcinogens. And we've been mostly working with fluoranthine, which is a potent P450 inhibitor that's relatively non-toxic in most situations on its own. Then, a little more recently, though, Mark mentioned this, we wanted to get away from, say, chemical manipulations, particularly inhibiting P450, because, we don't think most of these chemicals are innocuous. So we got really interested in this morpholino approach for gene knockdown that had been developed, at least with fish, as far as fish goes, with zebrafish, and a lot of very nice work done by, for example, Dick Peterson's group, looking at that dioxin toxicity in zebrafish embryos. So Alicia Timularegi was the next PhD student at Lyme. Alicia now doing postdoc work with Mark and an incredible student. And she did some very elegant work developing the morpholino approach, taking it against, or basically confirming this synergy, using it to knock down various genes. And that's what I'll talk about next. But
hey, Rich, this is Justin. Can you just real quick verify which slide you're on?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, now I'm on slide 70. Thank you, Justin. Sorry about that. So I'm now on slide 70, showing how a typical morpholino experiment is done. Brian Clark, who I just mentioned, in a postdoc in the lab, Cole Mattson, more recently, they basically modified this approach for working with fungalists, which was not a simple task. The fungalists were a good deal more challenging. They have very tough chorions. It turns out you could not just inject the morpholino into the yolk. You had to put it into the cell. So it shows how we do these experiments. We inject this morpholino that's, again, designed to knock down a specific gene. You have to have gene sequence data to do this. And then you have to do it very early at the 1-4 cell stage. At 24 hours, then that green glow is showing that, yes, the morpholino was incorporated into the embryo. These morpholinos can be tagged with fluorescein to give this a way to confirm incorporation. And then at 96 hours post-fertilization, we do the in ovo air assay I already talked about. And then at 144 hours post-fertilization, score for embryo deformity. So, and this method and so forth is well described in this aquatic tox paper at the bottom there. In slide 71 now, this is the next couple of slides are essentially going to show you a similar story of the aryl hydrocarbon receptor for PAHs as Mark described for the dioxin-like compounds. And again, this is experiments. These experiments are now just looking at sort of this mechanism of toxicity. We're not talking about the Elizabeth River fish per se. These are all Kings Creek fish. So in this slide, we're showing that it's essentially comparing the effects of the AHR1 morpholino and the AHR2 morpholino against BKF-induced deformities, and showing that, yes, the AHR2 shows this very strong protection The HR1 shows a slight tendency towards protection, but not so much. And the 1 and 2 is sort of intermediate, which fits those data. And this is even a little more pronounced this time using beta-naphtoflavone as our AHR agonist, where we're basically seeing no protection with the AHR1 knockdown, but strong protection with the AHR2. So this is basically saying that, yes, as consistent with the diosinolite compounds, these PAHs that are reasonably potent as PAHs go, as AHR agonists, are also the cardiotoxicity, teratogenesis, is also highly mediated by the AHR2. This is now, though, where, and I already alluded to the fact that the P450, the chemical inhibitors, synergistically enhance the toxicity of those pH-type inducers. And this is one major difference now with the dioxin-like chemicals. So in this case, we're looking at interaction between beta-naphtoflavone and the morpholino knockdown of CYP1A. And this is including data that shows that, yeah, you had to introduce the morpholino into the cell. If you did in the yolk, there was no effect. But we see now that we are. This is confirming that the morpholino did effectively knock down CYP1A expression when injected, at least into the cell. And now looking at deformities, you see that the non-injected BNF, that's without the morpholino, we increase toxicity a good deal. But when we knock down CYP1A, we tremendously increase that toxicity. This is in contrast to the dioxin-like compounds, in which case there's been different reports, but from Dick Peterson basically has concluded that knocking down CYP1A has no real effect on dioxin toxicity in zebrafish. Others have said it actually provides some protection, some Japanese workers. Here we're seeing that no, in fact, in the case of the PAH, it has this great synergy. So in terms of mechanisms of pH adaptation that can inform toxicity, you know, again, this AHR pathway responses seem to be very important, at least for these those higher molecular weight pHs that act as AHR agonists. In the interest of time, I'm not going to show you, there is some data showing some also upregulations of phase 2 and 3 detoxification responses by out of Peter's group and Charlie Rice's group at Clemson. And we've also shown evidence for upregulation of antioxidant defenses and actual increased resistance to challenges by prooxins. And so we often see in the literature the so-called resistant Elizabeth River killfish phenotype. I'll say, though, that's why I've underlined the AHR pathway, because I think it shows the strongest association with this resistant phenotype. So we also then wanted to ask, and these similar to some of the questions that Mark asked, are there fitness costs? Also, what about cross-resistance to other chemicals? So I want to show a few slides addressing this. And this now goes back to Joel's work, and this is looking at larval tolerance to hypoxia. So the upper line are King's Creek fish, and then the lower bottom colored lines are F1 and F2 Elizabeth River fish. And again, it's showing that, yes, they are much more sensitive to hypoxia to Elizabeth River fish. So here is what we would call a true fitness trade-off cost. These fish are notoriously resistant to hypoxia. They live in systems that can undergo hypoxia, and yet here we show some loss of ability to cope with hypoxia, which appears to be, again, genetic. Moving to slide 78, another experiment we decided to do. It's interesting, again, the florentine is an important pH out there. This, again, was early on. And at that time, we thought, well, maybe pH phototoxicity, which was being studied a lot at that time, might be a key driver. And so we did this experiment actually expecting the Elizabeth River fish to be more resistant. And again, saw just the opposite. That is that they are actually much more sensitive to phototoxicity than the King's Creek fish. So we can say, yes, there are some important fitness trade-off costs. Now, we wanted to look, and this is now bringing us back to the present with Brian Clark's dissertation work. Brian is asking the question about cross resistance. With the, and the, we're operating under, I think, a pretty straightforward hypothesis using, in this case, neurotoxic pesticides. Chlorpyrifos is an example of an organophosphate that is actually activated by P450. So our hypothesis here was that the Elizabeth River fish would be more resistant to chlorpyrifos because P450 activates chlorpyrifos to the more potent oxon. And if you look across the data, this is slide 79, sorry. We're on slide 79, I keep forgetting to say that. We're on slide, and this is showing clearly that the Elizabeth River fish are more resistant to chlorpyrifos than the King's Creek fish. But at least fitting with this notion of the role of P450, you note that when we induce P450 with beta-naphthalavone, we have, you know, very minimal effect on the King's Creek fish, but we actually increase the sensitivity of the King's Creek fish even further. So it's saying, yes, as we have more P450 activity, we're making the chlorpyrifos more potent. Permethrin, on the other hand, slide 80 now, is an insecticide that is metabolized, deactivated by P450. So in this case, our hypothesis was that the Elizabeth River fish would be more sensitive to permethrin. But again, notice that, no, again, they are highly resistant to permethrin. However, at least consistent with our theory is that when we induce with BNF, we at least reduce the sensitivity of the King's Creek fish, shown in the far right bar. So that at least fit that. But these data are, we really have no real explanation. The one potential explanation is that it's related to this upregulation of phase two or phase three proteins. But we have no idea. We were actually very surprised with this. So we talked about this Elizabeth River phenotype, and so as I mentioned, this so-called Elizabeth River resistant phenotype is based entirely on studies from the Atlantic wood superfund site, a rather small area within the Elizabeth River system. And so Brian also asked the question, well, how widespread is this resistance in the Elizabeth River system? And related then, well, how effective will some of the proposed remediation efforts be that are aimed at the Atlantic wood site? So slide 82 is showing in the orange symbols some other sites that Brian and we have worked on. The red circles are the three major now defunct creosote treatment plants that operated on the southern branch of the Elizabeth River. All three, as I understand, slated for cleanup in coming years. And slide 83 now is showing you the concentrations at these different sites. So you see on the upper left we have Kings Creek, 526 nanograms per gram, quite low. Atlantic Wood, 122,000, extremely high. And then on the right we see these other ones, Pescara Creek, Scuppletown Creek, and Jones Creek, which are elevated, certainly not near to the extent of Atlantic Wood. And then, interestingly, Maines Creek, on the bottom left and the bottom of the thing, has even lower concentrations than the reference site. And I'll mention that the Elizabeth River actually flows from south to north. However, near the Maines Creek, it intersects with the Intercoastal Canal, and also it's highly tidally influenced. So, you know, it's not like a rapidly moving river going from south to north. So it's sort of getting both tidal sloshing around as well as some south-north flow. So this is looking at, slide 84 is looking at these various subpopulation responses to the PAHs and PCBs. And so there you have Kings Creek, Atlantic Wood. So on the two far left ones are the ones we've been talking about, the two extremes. Kings Creek, the ref, are consistent reference site in Atlantic Wood. And then the next ones are the four other sites. And I don't want to belabor this and take a while. You can look at this, but the take-home message from this is that there is strong evidence of resistance to both people 50 inductions and to deformities at some of the other sites. Also, that there's not always a great correlation between inducibility and resistance. And there's also quite a variance in how different populations respond to different chemicals. So if you'll notice, for example, under PCB 126, the main streak site, the relatively clean site, shows a pretty remarkable resistance to PCB 126. So, I mean, with this, we are now concluding that perhaps just due to the hydrology of that system and moving around of pHs, as well as probably some moving around of the killifish, that this resistance is not just an Atlantic Wood phenomenon, that to some extent is probably spread throughout that system. So some of the conclusions, again, the phenotype is at least in part genetic. Fitness costs are incurred, also genetic. We see some cross resistances on slide 85. One thing I did not have time to mention, but very recently another recent PhD graduate, Lauren Wills, showed very interestingly that while the Elizabeth River, Atlantic Wood fish do demonstrate cancer in the field, they are more resistant. Their offspring are more resistant to cancer induced by laboratory exposures to benzoylpyrene, which actually fits, I think, the AHR story. Again, that adaptation involves downregulation of the AHR. And I think it's important, what I like to mention is that while we're so used as toxicologists to doing sort of classic dose response, looking at this resistance is a very neat way to look at mechanisms. If we can understand, well, how do organisms resist toxicity, it's a roundabout way, a very unique way to understand mechanisms of toxicity. And then again, that this Atlantic Wood phenotype is widespread in the Elizabeth River system. And then from the pH studies, the ones looking at the synergy, one of the more important things we've discovered is this very marked synergy between pHs that can act as agonists versus those that act as inhibitors. That is in contrast to the dioxin-like compounds. And current default assumptions of additivity of pHs is likely to be very underprotective in these systems, or in the case of pHs, that always occur as mixtures. And I'm often asked, well, what are the implications of this for human health? And I can't say I know. I have not observed studies addressing, say, heart development in mammalian models or in people exposed to pHs. I know the main effect associated with children born to heavy smokers is just reduced growth and just smaller birth weights and so forth. But I always like to end with this quotation, often some people say mistakenly attributed to Chief Seattle, but I'm sure he at least thought it. That is that all things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth befalls to the children of the earth. And then I'd like to acknowledge on slide 87 those involved with this wonderful lab group. Various labs that have helped me, really, particularly Mark's has been incredible over the years. We've enjoyed that. Diane's been great, and a number of other labs shown here, and of course our funding. And in slide 88, I've just been really blessed over the years with incredible students and postdocs shown here, and really appreciate their help. And I'll end on slide 89 with questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Rich, for another really great presentation. We do have time for a few questions, and we could go first to the phone line. Again, if you are putting in a question through the phone, please take your phone off mute by pressing *6 and state your name and organization. Do we have anyone on the phone lines? Okay, seems like the phone lines are a bit of a problem, but... but we do have some questions that have been submitted by our internet participants. First one we have is from Lisa Tomlinson of Arcadis in Brighton, Missouri. And her question is, what method was used to collect the sediment pour water from the Elizabeth River, and what are the approximate levels of PAHs measured in the pour water?
We basically just take superficial sediments, bring them back to the lab, and then spin them down. I could get you that data. I don't know those numbers. Those off the top of my head. All those numbers actually in that last figure would be from the pore water of those extracts. And those were numbers very recently collected.
Okay, I'd like to remind people on the line that there is the opportunity to email the presenters directly after the presentation, also if you want some further clarification. We do have another question on the line from an internet participant from Mary Walker of University of New Mexico. Is there any idea how long this resistance takes to develop and how many generation it takes for it to reverse, if it is reversible?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. As I recall, I believe Steve Diamond at the EPA in Duluth did some laboratory experiments, and as I recall, and I believe this was with phototoxicity, he was able to get resistance rather quickly, within three or four generations, as I recall. I don't recall anyone ever, I'm not aware in fish at least of people looking at how many generations it takes it to go away. You can see in our data by F2, it looks like it's being slightly attenuated. It's still certainly there. So I would certainly suspect in some number of generations it would revert back.
Thanks. Are there any questioners waiting on the phone lines at this point? All right, we do have other questions that we can take from our internet participants. Mary Walker has another question, and she asks, do you think there are useful genetic models in the mouse that might be useful to explore any of your identified mechanisms?
Are there any mouse models?
Yes, that's the question. Are there genetic models in the mouse that might be useful to explore your identified mechanisms?
Yeah, I would think that some of these AHR knockout mice that I know people like Dan Niebert have developed, I would think would be quite useful. Sure.
Another question from an internet participant, Jed Goldstone of Woods Hole. You mentioned that permethrin and chlorpyrifos interact with P450s. Do they specifically interact with CYP1A or with other CYPs?
My understanding is that they do interact with CYP1A, but I believe they're likely to interact with other CYPs as well.
Another question from an internet participant, and this question is directed to both Mark and Rich. And at this time, if others would like to submit questions to both Mark and Rich, we can open the discussion up a bit further. This question that was submitted by Tim Kubiak of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in New Jersey, first a compliment that this has been a great summary, and the comment that Mark's summary suggested Newark Bay was a PCB site when it really is the best for all pollutants. PCBD, it's the worst on the East Coast. PCBs, atypically high levels of PCB-11, PAHs, metals, including mercury. The differences across sites may reflect this overall exposure. And from Cooper's recent aquatic toxicology paper, Newark Bay fungalists have significantly reduced fecundity, not compatible for a resistance designation. Do you have any thoughts or comments about this? let me finish the rest of this question before I give you a chance to respond. Has anyone looked at this in your communal study sites? It seems very noticeable given the relatively small number of eggs. The question goes on, but I think that perhaps we could take a pause at this moment to respond to the fact that the participant, Tim Kubiak, is describing the sites as being really multiply contaminated and asking the question about a fitness cost, specifically reduced fecundity. Mark, would you like to give a quick response to this first off, and then Rich, if you'd like to follow up?
Sure. Yeah, first of all, I agree. Thanks, Tim, for your comment, and I agree that Newark is not easily characterized as a single contaminant. And you know, the initial work that Keith Cooper did years ago, he was looking at TCDD specifically, and I think in more recent work, Diane's group at the EPA has, I think you've measured PCB in the sediments there. So which of the contaminants at Newark are the ones that are driving the resistance is, I think, not clear, and probably some combination of all of them. With regard to the question about the recent results showing a decrease in fecundity in that population, I haven't read that paper carefully, so I can't comment specifically on it, but I could imagine that there might be a gradient of levels of resistance or differences in the degree of resistance in different parts of that site or moving out from that site, similar to the way that Diane's group at EPA has shown kind of a gradient of resistance moving out from New Bedford Harbor. I think that's correct. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that, Diane. So you might imagine that perhaps the fish that are at the heart of the site or that are most resistant, maybe those are the ones exhibiting the reduced fecundity, and maybe there's a sort of a balancing point where there's a lower degree of resistance and a smaller effect on fecundity that may be sort of maintaining the population. And this is all highly speculative, and I'm happy to be corrected on it. But I also know that there's been some work on fecundity in the New Bedford Harbor fish, and I don't remember the specifics of that work, but maybe Diane could comment on it if she remembers it.
Yeah, I can say that the New Bedford Harbor fish have a very high fecundity, that in laboratory studies it's not significantly different, but it's certainly been our casual observation in the laboratory that there is a very high rate of fecundity in New Bedford.
And this is Rich. I'll add that we don't see a difference between the Atlantic Wood and King's Creek fish in terms of fecundity in the lab, at least. One other, though, I wanted to mention another sort of a fitness cost, I think you might be able to call it, that has been not really well documented, but among researchers working with Elizabeth River fish has been noted, is that they are more prone in the lab to various infections and parasites and so forth. They appear to be immunocompromised, and I know Charlie Rice at Clemson is addressing that now.
Thank you. And Tim Kubiak ends his series of questions by suggesting that it's time to write a good review paper on the cost of resistance. And if you think that one hasn't been written yet, I think he'd like you to.
Okay. Brian and I are writing a review of the Elizabeth River story.
Terrific.
And Tim, feel free to forward that email with all these questions to me, and I'll be happy to talk to you offline about them, too. I know you always think really deeply about these things, and I enjoy getting your perspective.
Same here.
We do have another question online, and it is from John Stegeman of Woods Hole, who asks, has anyone looked for resistance in the co-occurring Fungalis majalis?
Not that I'm aware of.
Nor I. Diane?
Nor I either, for that matter.
Yeah, we do see them at the in the Elizabeth River and Kings Creek, but you know, just for the sake of focus, I guess we've just kept on Heteroclitus because they are definitely more abundant.
The only other additional point I can make to that is that we do have a publication done by a graduate student, Sean Rourke, describing Menidia, from New Bedford Harbor that suggests there might be some reduced sensitivity in Cyprinodon that travel transiently through New Bedford Harbor, but it is certainly not a definitive study. Do we have any other participants on the phone lines?
Hi. Phones are working, just listening.
Hi. I have a question. You said that some of the fish were, one of the costs of the contaminants was photosensitivity, and I was wondering if that was in natural light with UV or in the lab or what that was.
This was on the roof of our building in Durham, North Carolina.
Okay, so that was...
Hello, this is Louise White from Health Canada. I have to say I tried to ask a question and unmute before, and this is the first time it was successful, so you had some kind of technical difficulties. If you're wondering why nobody from the phone asked questions. Anyways, my question is, obviously I don't work that much on fish, but I just thought it was interesting. Generally, when we're setting guidelines for eco-health or human health, there's been this assumption of additivity of pHs and this in combination with this potency thing. You probably know all about it. And from what I'm hearing from your research is that there's evidence to show that that doesn't quite work, like with fluoranthine, which is relatively considered by itself non-potent, but increases potency in the presence of other pHs, which is usually the case. Do I have that? Do I have it all wrong? Or
no, I would say that and Mark can speak to this as well. But my sense is that the additivity model for developmental effects is probably pretty good for the dioxin-like compounds. However, I think it falls apart for the pHs for the reason you say. Fluoranthine.
Okay.
Is just, you know, it's considered phototoxic, but other than that, it's not considered at all a developmental toxin or so forth, but it clearly synergizes things like BKF and BAP.
Okay. And do you think there's enough evidence to make changes in the activity model?
You know, I think it would take a lot of number crunching, but I think you could do it. I mean, I think it's still... You know, it's going to be tricky because these pH mixtures are so complex, but I think, you know, I'm not the one probably to do that, but I think people could, you know, do rank orders or whatever of HR potency and rank orders of P450 inhibitory potency and come up with some sort of model that would be a little more accurate than assuming activity, which I think is wrong.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
Sure.
Thank you. Are there other phone participants waiting to ask a question? I think we can go back to our internet participants. We have a question that's come in from Xavier Azuega, another fungalist researcher who thanks both Mark and Rich for great presentations. He asks the question, in addition to cardiac teratogenesis, do PCBs or PAHs have an effect on other development endpoints in killifish, for example, embryo dry weight or body length of larvae?
Well, I could say certainly we see, you know, I think this is the same with dioxin-like compounds from Dick Peterson. You see things like head deformities, shortened tails, so it's probably our shortened body length. Some people have attributed that to the circulatory impacts, that they're just not getting good blood flow. But, yeah, there's certainly broader effects than just the heart.
Thanks, Rich. We do have another question from an online participant. Heather Henry of NIEHS asks, as this session was about wild populations, I wanted to ask you to speculate on how the diversity of the AHR, as you found in wild population, implicates how well the mouse is a model for real populations, because mice strains are inbred. And then could you speculate further about what kind of diversity exists in the AHR in humans? And I'll ask Mark to take this first.
Okay, can you repeat that question again? I want to make sure I...
It was a multi-part question that began asking about considering that you found a great deal of diversity of the AHR in these wild fish populations. Can you discuss that in terms of how well the mouse is a model for real populations, in that the mouse, different mice strains have been studied in terms of their AH receptor functionality? That's the first part of the question. The second part of the question has to do with a question about the diversity in the AH receptor in humans. Better?
Yes, thank you. So with regard to the mouse as a model for real populations, I'm not sure what real populations are, whether you're thinking about real populations of mice or populations of humans. Yeah, it's true that a lot of the work in mice has involved, almost all of the work in mice has involved inbred strains, and, you know, they're used because the variability in response when you use an inbred strain is much lower, so you can get an answer using many fewer animals. And then also specific strains have been developed for certain experimental reasons because of certain features they have. So there's certainly value in that kind of an approach. I think when one works on an inbred strain, whether it's a mouse or something else, one always has to keep in mind that you're dealing with a highly sort of unnatural situation, and whatever you learn from that needs to then be sort of verified in a more of an outbred system. With regard specifically to the question about whether the mouse is a good model for humans in terms of dioxin-like compounds, there has been a lot of work done comparing the properties of the mouse and human AHRs. A lot of this work was done by, or is being done by, Gary Perdue's lab at Penn State. And there are, you know, substantial differences in AHRs from the two species, as well as differences among mouse strains, of course. But in general, human AHRs tend to have a lower affinity for dioxin, or dioxin-like compounds, but there are also ligand-specific differences, things that will bind to the AHR in one in one species but not the other. So there are some, you know, real important differences between the AHRs in mice and humans, and these clearly need to be considered carefully when trying to extrapolate from studies in mice to a human situation. With regard to the human AHR diversity, it's interesting. There was a lot of work done 10 or 15 years ago by Ellen Oakey's group in Toronto looking at variability in human responses to dioxin-like compounds. I think using placenta and some other kinds of samples, and they found evidence, and maybe also peripheral blood lymphocytes, and they found some evidence for pretty dramatic variability among individual humans in their response, or in the response of the tissues, to dioxin-like compounds. But when they looked at AHR, at the AHRs in the same samples, my recollection is that they saw very little diversity in AHR sequence among those individuals, and nothing that explained the differences in responsiveness to the compound. So, you know, clearly one lesson, not only from those studies, but in general from looking at the literature, is that the AHR is not the answer to, it doesn't explain all the differences that can occur in the ability of different species or populations to respond to these compounds. And we certainly focused on the HR, I think for good reasons, but we always keep in mind that there are going to be other factors that could influence the response of a system to dioxin-like compounds that might either be independent of the HR or that might, impinge on the HR signaling pathway in some way, but not involve differences in the HR itself. So I think it's a really good question, and it raises a bunch of points that I sort of can't do justice to in a short answer, but it's important to keep all these things in mind.
Thanks, Mark. We have another question from an internet participant. It's Bruce Wooden from Woods Hole, who asks, do you think that poorly metabolized and thus bioaccumulating compounds, for example, chlorinated hydrocarbons, in these populations confer protection against transient predators which lack the adaptive resistance to these compounds, for example, eels and birds that prey upon these fish? And he also comments, thanks for great presentations. Mark, would you like to take this first? Or?
Sure, I'll take a shot at this.
Okay.
The question is, do poorly metabolized compounds like the halogenated compounds that accumulate in these resistant animals somehow confer protection against predators? I guess the question is whether the predators would be consuming enough of the prey that had these high concentrations to affect the health of the predators. And for something that's transient, like a snapper blue coming in and out of New Bedford a few times during the summer, my guess is that, and I don't know, but my guess would be that they would eat a contaminated fungulus just as readily as they'd eat a clean fungulus. I suppose one could imagine, or one could ask whether the presence of the contaminants affects the flavor or the something of the prey, but I have no idea what the answer to that is.
Rich, do you want to make any comments about that? Any ecological implications about predators and consumption of these adapted fish?
Well, of course, in the Elizabeth River, we don't have particularly high levels of the chlorinated hydrocarbons, as far as I know, insecticides or PCBs. Certainly, one concern might be, I think we do have evidence consistent with the molecular data to show that they do metabolize, indeed, pHs more slowly than ones from clean sites, so presumably they might contain more unmetabolized pH in their tissues than fungus from a clean site, and therefore, you know, you might actually even predict that there would be higher risk of, say, teratogenic effects in birds eating those. But again, it probably just depend on the lines of what Mark said of, how strict or how important a part of the diet are those Elizabeth River fish from a site like the Atlantic Wood. And in that case, I wouldn't think it'd be huge. I mean, these sites like that are pretty spotty throughout that whole area.
Thank you. I'd like to take just a minute here to provide a little bit more information, and then if we have one last question, we can get back to it. I would like to make sure everyone is aware of the links pages and the online feedback form. The links page, we've assembled resources directly applicable to today's topics. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanism for these webinars. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation. I'd also like to remind everyone that the next webinar scheduled in this SRP Eco-Risk series will be on September 23rd from 2 to 4 p.m. and will feature EPA's Bruce Duncan and Harvard University's Jim Shine. The topic will be new biologically based tools that can be used to assess ecological risk. But I also would like to add that registration for this webinar is not yet open, but there will be a mailing to the Risk E-Learning listserv as soon as that webinar registration is open. We have time for one additional question if we have anyone on the phone lines. And we have one additional comment, perhaps, that we have had sent in from an Internet participant, from Jimmy Sparrow, who comments that the data that you present show genetic variation in susceptibility to PCBs and PAHs and selection for resistance. But other species and populations may not show this genetic variation for resistance. These data raise question regarding the choice of animal models for use in toxicity screening assays. If resistant populations were used in toxicity screening assays, it could seriously underestimate effects on other populations. While Dr. Sparrow does not end his remark with a question, I'd like to ask Rich if he would like to make some comment about these resistant populations and how they might either be useful or in other ways might provide some opportunity to enhance our understanding about how long-term exposure to contaminants affects population health.
Sure. I think just the issue of the how pollution drives evolution is a really important one. And even though this multi-generational exposures might drive resistance to that exposure, I think it's clear there are fitness costs there, and there are trade-offs that reduce ability to cope with natural stressors like hypoxia and sunlight and so forth. So, and in addition, as I try to highlight, and we're pushing this hard right now, is that by seeing, for example, Joel showed this remarkable resistance of the fungalus river to challenges with T. beta peroxide, a classic prooxidant, and that's been actually very telling in pushing our interest in how, in addition to the HR pathway, that antioxidants could play a role in this. Also, in response to his comment, if I understood it right, yeah, he's certainly right. You could way underestimate risks if you used offspring or whatever from these resistant populations. But, you know, again, if I were, I think killifish could be a great eco-risk model, but you would want to be very careful that you derive your populations from very clean sites, in which case they're going to show similar sensitivity as a lot of fish species, and much greater sensitivity to many, and they're a great model for going back and forth to connect lab studies with field studies. I think they're one of the best for that.
Thanks, Rich. Mark, would you like to make any comment about that issue, the use of fungalus relative to ecological risk, or would you like to make any other final comment as we're coming up to the end of the seminar session?
Well, I'd like to say I agree with what Rich just said in response to the comment from Dr. Sparrow. I also agree with Dr. Sparrow's comment and it's a good point, that not every species has the capacity to evolve resistance at these contaminated sites. And we've chosen to focus on one that does have that capacity, because the conditions are right, the genetic diversity is there, the generation time is right, the population size is right. But for other species, they might not be so adaptable, and so it's important to keep that in mind.
Thank you, Mark. Any other comments you'd like to make as we're coming to the close of the seminar?
No thanks.
I just thank everyone for their participation. Appreciate it. And thank you, Diane. You did a great job moderating.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone, and thanks to our speakers. I remind you once again that there's additional information available to you if you'd like to check up on this topic area, and you can contact the speakers directly if you'd like to follow up. I thank both Dr. Hahn and Dr. DiGiulio for really excellent participations, and thank the participants for some really good questions and stimulating some interesting discussions. Thank you all very much.